Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host here in America. It is Memorial Day, so if you're here in the United States with us, happy Memorial Day. And around the world, welcome. We're glad you're here. Memorial Day is one of the Mondays in May each year when we memorialize, we remember all those who gave their lives in the service of this country, in the military service of this country. And that's a lot of people. And we have a lot to be grateful for because they made possible the life that we live. So thank you very, very much. It's also, you know, Veterans Day is the day where we thank veterans. But I always think Memorial Day, you know, you're remembering the military service. It's okay to thank a veteran on this day. They'll probably be okay with it if you say it.
Yeah, I know people will be like, save it.
No, I didn't die in the war. Leave me out of this. That's my veteran's voice.
They're very respectful. Yeah.
Did you think...
Very tastefully done.
Thank God. We do thank God, and we pray for the repose of the souls and the glorious entry into heaven of all those who have died in the military service of this country.
I do appreciate this is the one day a year where Protestant brothers and sisters realize
pray for
we
the
can
dead.
Pray for the dead.
Joe, you got to turn everything ideological. Everything's
it's not ideal. It's just a basic spiritual point that they can't help. But it's like at Christmas where they were like, oh, yeah, we should have statues of Mary. And then they put them away again.
I know. It's just that a statue of Mary is okay as long as Joseph is there and the three wise men are there and there's some animals.
The ox baby and Jesus. The sigh.
Yeah. The ox and the what?
Sorry. The ox and the ass.
Oh, Joe,
did I get? I was gonna leave it implicit,
I didn't even get it. That's what a sigh I am.
Hopefully, we don't get pulled from the stations now because you made me spell that joke out.
No, because that's an actual description of an animal.
It is.
I cannot say the female dog one.
No,
although,
I can't.
Have
I
you
can't.
Ever watched a dog show? Like, you're watching some respectable TV channel, and they got a dog, and they just keep saying that word, and you're like, how can you come up with a different word?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those, like, it's kind of like, you know, to the pure, all things are pure, where you just hear, like, sometimes people who are very holy will say things where you're just like, ooh. It's not how I would word that.
Is that the word you want to use? Okay, so it's...
This has, again, gone off the rails within 30 seconds, which is
The problem with me doing... This is the problem with me doing radio with you.
I think
that
would be a good call-in show, too.
With the problem with Cy? No, that's not a good call-in show. I enjoy conversation with you.
Likewise.
And so I get sidetracked by the pleasant conversation.
Well, thank you.
I heard that you and Chris Check got in trouble with Jack when you were on the air together.
Yes,
you were talking too much.
I want to point out,
is Jack
it was
there?
Too much banter, but it's about hiking, and I said not a word about hiking, because what would I add to that conversation?
Jack tells me too, though. Jack's good about telling me, like, okay, enough.
He's Gen Z, so you know how their attention spans are.
Oh, yeah, he's not listening now. He doesn't even actually know that we're talking about him when he wakes up.
He's like, these answers should be short enough to go on TikTok. I've already lost attention 20 seconds.
Right. Time. Well, this isn't a clip. My whole life is clips. This isn't a clip.
Your answer is three parts?
Oh, so what was I talking about? Oh, yeah, Society 315.
It's, lack of attention span, I think.
Society 315, our primary giving society here at Catholic Answers. All the questions come from Society 315 today. It's a really, really good idea. And I think it was it Michelle's idea? I think it was Michelle's idea. I think it's Darren's idea then. If he goes, I don't know, that means it was his idea. okay, so Michelle and Darren came up with this, and we really like it because it's really great to have contact with the members of Society 315, and we try to keep in contact. In all kinds of different ways. And should I read one or do a video one?
Let's do a video one.
We start with a video one. All right. Some of the questions were submitted via video. And here's another one.
Hi, I'm Allison.
And I'm Colin.
And we're from Canada. And we live in a rural area where it's difficult to find things like Catholic art locally.
In the past, I've 3D printed things such as this simple cross. But my question is it morally permissible to 3D print Catholic icons and statues for personal use?
Thank you.
That is the sweetest Canadian couple. I love that we get the video.
Yeah.
They are just charming people. And they do need more art. Just look at the wall behind them.
Oh, wow. Wow. No one's going to feel safe doing a video call because they're going to be like, if I use a fake background, they're going to talk about that.
No,
but if I use a real one.
You know, the Canadians have this reputation for being nice that we Americans deride because we're Americans. Yes. And we don't. But what a nice couple.
Yeah, they were.
All right, so I didn't quite understand the question, though. Like, there could be an icon. I don't know how you would three print, maybe, let's say a statue. Or so would it be immoral to 3D print Michelangelo's Pietà or something like that? Is that what they're asking?
Yeah, I think that's what they're asking. So I was trying to think about the different kind of moral questions that could be relevant there. One is using something that is respectful. So, you know, I made fun of Gen Z, so I should probably make fun of boomers for having really tacky religious art, you know, the plastic Jesus and like dashboard Jesus and all of this. It's like, that's not the respect to our Lord.
Is that the boomers? I think that might have been the generation before.
It might boomers. Be. The silent generation.
The greatest silent. Generation actually is the greatest generation. Not a lot of good taste with art.
Fair enough.
I mean, they're the greatest generation, yeah. But some hokey art.
Yeah, it's That's all I got to say. I don't want to bash a bunch of greatest generation people on Memorial Day, but I will say we should have tasteful religious art, and taste doesn't just mean the appearance. It also means like the material, that you don't want something that's gauche.
Yeah.
And you don't want something that's ephemeral. One of the constant complaints about a lot of modern churches is that depending on where you are, you might be in a suburb that you don't know if the suburb's even going to be there in 5 years. And everything
right, everything like, has a kind of transitory,
right.
Doesn't matter. It's like, to quote the Pope, a throwaway culture.
Yeah, and this is a real problem, that we live in a culture where everything is disposable. And that's actually spiritually dangerous.
Yes, right.
And so you don't want a throwaway kind of religious thing. Now, I don't understand enough about 3D printers to be able to answer the question of, could you have something that still is respectable material? It seemed like you could.
Well, that cross that he held up, I mean, I couldn't, I can't tell much about it, but it looked...
Right. And so in that sense, I think that they're asking a valid question. I don't think that they would be, it doesn't seem like it's gaudy. It doesn't seem like it's something ephemeral or something that's going to fall apart in 2 days. And so in that sense, I think it's fine. And the other question that could potentially come up would be something like copyright, you know, if you don't want to use somebody else's protected product and take away an artist's livelihood. And then the last thing is, but there is a distinction between the art and the copy of the art. You know, you can mass produce the Mona Lisa and it's not the Mona Lisa. You can mass produce the Pietà and it's not the Pietà. Okay, that's fine. But if the copy is still something that draws the mind and heart to God, I think it's still doing important work. Like an art purist may say that's not as good as the real thing. Fine. But until Michelangelo moves to Canada, Michelangelo...
Make Angelo. I can't do a Canadian accent. I apologize
turns
to
out,
all of Canada.
Both of us realized midway through that
we
Canadian
started.
Accents are harder than they seem. Yeah.
Just, you know what I found? If you ever do offend a Canadian, just talk about poutine. And then you're okay.
Yeah. I'm actually a little annoyed America didn't invent fries plus gravy plus cheese.
How is poutine not an American thing?
I agree.
Like, that seems so American. Let's put some extra fat on those fries.
Yeah, like, these fries seem a little too healthy.
Yeah.
But in any case, all that's to say, I think it's a great idea. I think this is a good use of 3D printers, if I'm understanding everything correctly.
You know what, though? While we're on art, because we got a minute, mm-hmm. and I'm very grateful to Allison in Canada, and thank you for supporting us, Allison and Colin in Canada. There used to be a kind of Catholic patronage of the arts, and well, I'll tell you a little story. Whereas about 20 years ago, I worked for the Bishop of San Diego, and they make their ad limina visit, and they visit the various offices in Rome, and he said that in one of the offices, and I don't remember which, maybe it was for the propagation, I can't remember what, maybe it was the evangelization office, I don't know. They ask you questions about the report you've submitted, which is called a quinquennial report, every 5 years. The diocese has to
see what they call it.
Yeah. And so, yeah, it's clever. They say things just like we do, but in Latin over there. And so this archbishop said to the bishop, well, what are you doing in your diocese to patronize the arts? The bishop said he was surprised by it. Like, oh, I didn't see that question coming.
Yeah.
But that's actually quite a basic question for a bishop or a pastor, or especially for wealthy lay Catholics. Patronizing the arts is a very important way of sharing the faith. And beautiful art in your church. And I'm not talking about art where you're rich, so you go, I want it to look exactly like this. No, that's not patronizing the arts. That's bossing people around. I mean,
Might be a patronizing attitude.
Yeah, but finding great artists and supporting their art, whether it's music or the graphic arts, I think is a really important thing, and we don't do it as well anymore.
Yeah, I went to, in Umbria, about an hour, hour and a half north of Rome, there was a Renaissance museum there that had a bunch of basically regional, like, middle of Italian, not super populated area, like 14th and 15th century religious art. And it was incredible. I mean, the quality of the art, but also the sheer quantity of the art. You just realize, like, okay, imagine all this stuff not in museums, but in churches and just all over the place. Because you have that much art. You don't have that many people. People were exposed to beautiful art wherever they turned. And you can still see it. If you walk around Rome, not on your phone, and actually with your head up, you will see on corners just random religious art.
Oh, the, especially the Marys. There's a name for those Marys on the corner. Does anybody in the studio... where they have the
Mary of the street?
No, for the, it's like a little shrine to Mary that's about usually about two stories up, and it's on the corner.
I don't know the name for that. I saw those all the time.
But you could do that at your house. You know, like you could have not kitschy, but a beautiful piece of art that would draw people to Jesus or to the saints or just to the reflection on the holy life.
Yeah, my wife, her family is Eastern European, and so there's a bunch of icons in our house, and it's a great conversation starter, too. It's beautiful. It draws the kids' imagination. They talk about the saints. They talk about the stuff they're seeing in the icons.
Yeah.
But then visitors to the house also. I had a lady come over. I was getting a CPAP machine and needed, like, a home visit for to make sure I wasn't going to die, I guess. And she came over, and she started talking, and she's... she was an Anglican, but she really liked the art, and it led to a great, beautiful conversation with this total stranger.
Yeah. Well, I have a friend who's not wealthy, you know, but when he had some money, he loves icons, and he actually commissioned some icon writers, I guess is the way you're supposed to say it, you know, someone who can make icons. And they don't look like... a mass-produced thing. They look like original works. And I just think that's important because you're supporting the artist who's trying to do a spiritual good by making that art, but you're also just bringing something into the world that manifests God's beauty.
Yeah, I've got one hand-painted icon. A lot of the ones I guess I have two. A lot of the ones are mass-produced, I guess, but they don't look like it. But the two hand-painted ones are still... or handwritten ones that, you know, some Easterners prefer to call it writing icons than painting them.
Yeah.
Because you're telling the story.
Well, Allison and Colin, thank you very, very much for the question. And
so 3D printing is good, but if you can afford to patronize the arts.
Yeah. Because, one of the things is artistic skills atrophy in a culture.
Yes.
If there's nobody who masters the skills of painting because there's no way to make a living as a master painter, then you actually... are atrophying as a society. And you know, up in San Francisco, Archbishop Corleone founded the Benedict XVI Institute and has produced beautiful music. You know, Frank, help me out. Now I should never say people's names on the air the wonderful composer, the Mass of the Americas, like a really original work of art, not an imitation of Bach, but something that includes, you know, Mexican folk
Frank
music.
Frank LaRocca.
Frank LaRocca, the great Frank LaRocca, yeah. And so that's important that Archbishop Corleone did that, these are things that we leave for generations after. And if you, you know, can, I don't know, give money to your parish for a great work of art, everyone who walks into that church for generation after generation will have the opportunity to have the spirit enlivened by that.
Yeah, very well said.
All right. Thanks again, Allison and Colin. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more questions from Society 315 on Catholic Answers Live.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Faith is a precious gift from God. As the largest religious media network in the world, EWTN has an important role in educating others about our Catholic faith and spreading the good news of salvation. We invite you to explore our numerous pages of historical faith documents, prayers, teachings, and other current issues in Catholicism today. Visit EWTN.com and click Catholicism. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Lots and lots of video questions. We've never done this before, and I'm very happy with it because it's so much fun to see people ask their questions. And I guess they're just sending us in VHS tapes. Is probably how it's working, right? They just mail the VHS tape in, and then we play it in the VCR machine that we have.
Yeah, I appreciate the dwindling number of people who are going to get these references.
I know, it's weird that I can remember when VCR started, and now it's over.
I remember when we moved to the kind of hard disk that you used, the save icon. I remember when that kind of disk was new because we were using the 5 1/4 inch floppies.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. My big, technological thing, because now you look at the disk and you're just like, the save button doesn't look like anything I see anymore.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. The too much change, Darren. Well, that's it. No more of these video shows. It's making me nostalgic for the days before video.
Record a gramophone recording that we can play on the air?
Exactly.
In all seriousness, so two things. One, even though we're calling it Catholic Answers Live, not a live episode today. It's pre-recorded for Memorial Day.
Right.
Two, this is all people who are part of Society 315, our monthly giving society. And I love Society 315 because monthly givers are really crucial. Because then you're not just totally reliant upon the largesse of the rich, and the largesse of sporadic givers, right? Like having monthly giving at an affordable rate means when the economy takes a weird turn, we don't have to say, "Oh no, can we pay the month, next month's bills?"
Right.
But also, anyone joining Society 315, if you like what you're listening to, if you like the idea of being able to ask your question either in written form or even better on video. Join and then send in your question to Michelle. I think we're going to do more of these. Yeah. Shall we call them closed forum questions?
Yeah, it's closed forum. I said open forum, but it's really closed. It's closed. Only members of Society 315.
And it's all pre-recorded. Everything.
Let's wear our members only jackets next time when we do this. Yes. Because we both have them, Joe. All right. So why 315 though? I said it before. Yes. We forgot to say why Society 315 is called Society 315.
1 Peter 3:15. Says to always be prepared to make a defense, apologia, where the word apologetics comes from, to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and reverence, and keep your conscience clear, so that when you're abused, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame. It's actually 15 to 16, because
you want to get the shaming part in there.
Yes.
Yeah. and that, which is more or less the mission statement of Catholic Answers. I mean, it's not exactly.
It's more or less the mission statement of Christianity.
Yeah. Okay.
This is what we should all be doing.
So you want to put things in order of importance. Christianity first, yes. And then Catholic Answers next. All right.
It's like if you take this seriously, there is a universal call. There's, people know, I think, increasingly, Catholics have an awareness. There's a universal call to holiness. Sanctity isn't just for a select few. Everyone is called to be a saint. But what sometimes goes ignored is that there's also a universal call to proclaim the gospel. And that if you don't do that, you won't go to heaven. I mean, this is very clearly taught by Christ and by the church. This is not an optional thing. You either proclaim Christ or you don't. And if you don't, you won't like your eternal choices. And so it's something that people should take very, very seriously. I need to proclaim Christ. And if I'm going to do that, I should probably be good at it. If I want to be good at it, I should probably practice it and do more and learn more and study and pray and do all these things. So that's just my pitch for taking holiness and evangelization seriously. But there you go.
Yeah, it's a good pitch. This next question comes from Anonymous in Portland, Oregon. And he or she says, my question is based on a recent debate. Some of them I'm reading, not all of them are video, just for those of you who just joined us. My question is based on a recent debate a friend and I had. Would it technically be okay to wear an upside down cross as a necklace to represent St. Peter's cross? We both love the representation of humility and devotion St. Peter had, and the symbolism is amazing. But people assume upside down crosses are satanic. It could be a conversation starter, but then again, it could send an odd message. So technically, two questions. Is it okay, and would it be prudent?
Yeah, well, the second question is very easy to answer. No, it's not prudent.
It would freak me out if I saw it.
Yeah. So the example I'd like to give is that in Sardinia, there is a saint venerated there, Saint Lucifer of Cagliari. And I would just say, yeah, don't put up an icon to Saint Lucifer in your house. Because even though the guy seems to have been probably holy, there's some disputes about whether he's even a saint or not. His name is Lucifer. And so, yes, it means light bearer, but these days we associate all of that with the devil. And so a Saint Lucifer sounds like you're worshiping the devil. This is, by the way, why we say Saint Jude. His name is Judas, but just to avoid anyone misunderstanding who we mean,
yeah,
we say Saint Jude.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
That's, you know, like we go out of our way to avoid unintentionally scandalizing people, even if we mean a good thing. You know, you'll find old school, like 19th century English stuff that uses the old form of worship to mean honor. So it'll say, oh, we worship Mary, just like we worship the saints, we worship, you know, the excellent people. And it's like, okay, it means honor there. It doesn't mean worship in the modern sense. But retranslate that so that you don't have people being scandalized and misled. That, you know, hopefully that's clear, that you don't want to mislead someone into falsehood. So in that sense, if you want to depict Peter crucified upside down, in certain contexts, that might be okay. But just wearing a necklace where someone's likely to see it and think you're embracing Satan is, I think, too scandalous. I would avoid anything that leads someone else into sin because it's wrong to do that on purpose.
There was a guy in the 500s who became pope, and his name was Mercurius. You know about this.
Yeah, he changed his name.
He changed his name to John. And that's actually where the tradition of popes changing. Yep. People think it comes from Peter, and it's related to that. But it started with Mercurius because he's named after the god Mercury.
Right.
And he's elected pope of the – or I don't know how they –
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. And he's like, I can't be named after the god Mercury
and
be the pope of the church. So what a great question, though. What a very good question. All right, let's do another video question.
All right.
We got one? Sorry, I didn't mean to surprise you guys. Go ahead.
Hi, Si. Hi, Joe. This is Kelly from Weatherford, Texas.
Hi, Kelly.
We know from the Gospels that Peter is married because Jesus heals his mother-in-law. My question is, do we know if Peter's wife was alive during his ministry, and did they have any children? Thanks.
Yeah, I love this question because, okay, so first of all, I like it because this is something that people don't often think about because they'll just say, oh, yeah, we get Peter's mother-in-law, so he must have had a wife and kids and all this.
Right.
It doesn't appear that way. We know that for a few reasons.
Wait, it doesn't appear that he had kids or doesn't appear that
doesn't
he had a wife?
Doesn't appear he had a living wife when he's following
Jesus. Oh, living
Jesus.
Wife. I got you.
And
yeah.
So, yeah, the reason is when his mother-in-law is sick, as soon as she's healed, she starts taking care of the house and like, taking care of Peter and Jesus. Now, this is one of those things that socially at the time would have fallen to the woman. And so where is Peter's wife during this? Like, why isn't she doing this? There's no way to say that doesn't sound a little like, I don't know, sexist or something. But I'm saying, like, she's notably absent in this place we would expect to find her, especially if her mother is sick. And there's no reference to her. We don't know her name. We don't know anything about her. And so it may well be that she is dead. Or more controversially, there were cases of men who would basically get separated from their wives to go follow a rabbi. I'm skeptical that happened here. I think it's more likely that Peter was a widower. But yeah, Peter's traveling all around. Now, notably, when Jesus is proclaiming kind of the high message of the gospel, Peter says to him, we've given up house and home and family and all this to follow you. And Jesus says that those who've done this will be rewarded. And so he's making it very clear, like in his response to Peter, Jesus mentions those who've given up families specifically.
Yeah.
Peter seems to be on that list because Peter's the one asking the question. It'd be weird if Peter asked this question about what's going to happen to him and Jesus gives him an unrelated answer. Just like, oh, other people, this is what's going to happen. No, Peter's asking about himself, and Jesus is promising that these sacrifices that he and the others have made won't go unrewarded. So there's good indication from this that all of the apostles seem to have given up marriage. It's just how they're able to travel all around. Peter's in Jerusalem, he's in Antioch, he's in Rome, he's traveling all over the place. Not as much as Paul, maybe, but still traveling pretty extensively. Now, the other line people will sometimes stumble upon is when St. Paul is talking about how he has a right as an apostle to have, and then many translations say, a believing wife, as the apostles do. So it doesn't actually say that. It just says women or a woman. And in context, this is referring to the fact that there were women who would take care of the apostles, just like there were women who followed Jesus who would take care of Jesus. Yeah. And so this was not about marriage. This was a financial thing that Paul is foregoing these comforts. So evidence points to the apostles probably having been unmarried and celibate during the time they're following Jesus onward.
Okay. Well, thanks. It's a great question, Anonymous. Thanks very, very much. We got to take a quick break. Right back with more questions for Joe Heschmeyer right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Are you ready to defend your faith in a world of unbelief? Join us at the 9th Annual Catholic Answers Apologetics Conference. This year's theme, I Believe in God, and it'll help you provide clear and charitable answers to atheism, agnosticism, and plain old indifference. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us in San Diego from September 21st through 24th as we welcome our special guest, Dr. Scott Hahn, and an all-star lineup of great Catholic speakers. Spend quality time with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and enjoy 4 days of fun, fellowship, and adoration of the Almighty. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register. Enter promo code EARLY and save $50. That's CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. I got to apologize to Kelly. I don't know what I was reading the wrong. My eyes were on the wrong spot, and Kelly was so nice and even included me in her question by saying hi, Cy, at the beginning. And then I said that question was from Anonymous, and Kelly was not Anonymous. She was, as a matter of fact, quite gracious. So sorry about that, Kelly. With Joe here, it does remind me to invite you to come with us on the big Catholic Answers pilgrimage, the Flannel Panel pilgrimage to Rome, coming up in November. The Flannel Panel is Joe and Chris Check, and then I moderate those panels. We all wear flannel shirts and talk about the news of the day. And if you'd like to join us in Rome, Chris and Joe know Rome very, very well, and I'm good company. I don't know. I was trying to think of some selling point for me going, but I don't want them to go without me, so I'm going. And we're going to have a great time. It's a real pilgrimage. We'll be staying right by the Forum in Rome. We're not going to be bussing you in every day from outside of Rome. We're not going to be going other places. You're really going to get to see the city and know the city. For me, the most beautiful part of a visit to Rome is the Scavi tour, and we'll do the Scavi tour. If you're not familiar with that, you can see the bones of Saint Peter.
You're under Saint Peter.
Yeah, you're under the altar, the high altar of Saint Peter's, directly under it, where the body of Saint Peter was discovered, or the bones of Saint Peter were rediscovered. Oh, I guess the 1940s or something. Is that about right? 1940s.
It was during the 40s. It was done secretly to avoid letting Hitler know.
Oh, you can never let Hitler in on stuff.
Yeah, you know, you've seen Indiana Jones.
Oh my gosh, yeah. If you've seen the Indiana Jones movies, yeah, don't tell him where the Ark of the Covenant is. But it's we'll do the show. We'll do a version of the show where all the questions will come from the folks who are with us, and Joe will be giving talks. Chris will be giving talks, and we're only taking 50 people with us. So the way you find out about coming, we're only taking 50 because we don't like to have a large group. We have a small footprint, and everybody gets to, you know, get in on the conversation wherever we go, and we talk about the art, or we talk about a particular church, or you visit a saint. You know, sometimes you're like, I will never forget the day I was in a church there in Rome, and turn around and St. Aloysius Gonzaga is right next to me. And it's just an amazing thing about Rome. Like, if you want to talk about St. Aloysius Gonzaga while standing next to his tomb, then we'll do that. We just have a great time. And really, it's quite beautiful. And we'd love you to come. You go to CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com if you want to come. CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. And you're going to be there, Joe.
I am. I'm looking forward to it.
Are you going to get a new flannel shirt, or are you going to wear...
I haven't fully decided, but it'll definitely be easy to pack.
I'm going to give you a flannel shirt, because I have a flannel shirt that I have not given you from Anne, who is a wonderful person, and gave us new flannel shirts.
This is exciting.
But I haven't given you yours yet.
Well, Anne, you know now who the bully is in this relationship.
No, it's not that I'm a bully. It's that they got into a certain place in my house, folded up, nice, ready to go, and they never made their way to Joe. And I don't want to wear mine until Joe has his. And I think Chris has worn his already.
Oh, there you go.
I think so.
Sorry, Ann.
So bring your flannel. We're going to Rome with the flannel panel, CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. This hour is completely devoted to questions from Society 315 folks. I'm going to read you one. All right, Joe?
Okay, let's do it.
Because I just like being involved. Amanda. Amanda in Redmond, Oregon. Starts with this. This is a two-part question. All right, Amanda, here we go. Is God actually involved in the creation of every human life, or just the chosen ones? And she puts chosen ones in quotes. And then, meaning maybe some people are created simply as a scientific effect of the procreational act. And then I'll give you the second part too, and you can just answer them both, or do you want?
Well, you know, let's answer that one first. Okay. That one's the easy part.
All right.
Because the answer to that is yes, God is involved with the creation of every person, and not only every person. Jesus says in Matthew 10:29, "Are not two parrots?"
He doesn't say anything about parrots. He never mentions parrots once in the Bible.
Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? See, there were S, P, S, and P words in there, and they all came together as one beautiful word. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground without your Father's will? That there is this sense in which absolutely everyone... Now, in saying that, we're not denying that your mom and dad may have had something to do with your being here.
Really? You're willing to concede something?
I don't want to get too... This isn't that kind of show.
But we're co-creators with God, though.
Yeah. The question, what percentage was God and what percentage was your parents, would be like asking, like, what percentage of, you know, the Last Judgment was Michelangelo and what percentage was paintbrushes? It's two levels of causality.
Oh, right.
And so when we talk about human will and human contribution, when we're talking about the creation of a new life, whether we're talking about salvation, all of these things, we can describe them as being fully God and fully man, because God's will, it's not on the same level of causality as human will. So it's like comparing the painter to the paintbrushes. So all that's the easy part of the question. Yes, you were created by God. You were not just some weird scientific accident God didn't have any control over. There's no category of things that are outside of God's sovereignty.
I just wanted to mention about the chosen ones. I mean, in a certain sense, God only creates chosen ones because He does will the salvation of everyone. Everybody is chosen for salvation. And then the part two, if he is involved in the creation of every human life, and so many people do not make it to heaven, and God is omniscient, wouldn't that mean that God is knowingly creating people he knows will go to hell? If that is true, and are there any thoughts, ideas on why he would do that?
See why I called the first one the easy question?
Yeah, I know, right? The problem of evil. Thank you so much. We'll do that in 1 minute, Amanda.
Yes. This is I think the hardest, maybe the hardest question in just Christian theology of like, why does God create the damned? And there are different ways you can answer that. Because one of the questions is how many people are damned? Because we, at least emotionally, deal with it very differently if we're thinking, okay, why does God create Hitler if he knows Hitler's going to do bad stuff and go to hell? It's a really different thing if you believe that like most people are going to hell or, massa damnata, that kind of theory. Then it really starts to become, well, why create the world at all if most creation is going to be so badly disfigured that it can't be reunited with God? And so this is one of the reasons some people lean into daring to hope that everyone will be saved. So I don't know how many people are saved. There are certainly indications in Scripture that the way is narrow to heaven and the way to perdition is wide. We should nevertheless hope and pray for the salvation of everyone. I would say don't get too caught up on the number. Hope for the best, prepare for the worst in the sense of be sure to evangelize, be sure to bring people to Jesus and take that seriously. But I think we've intentionally not been given many clues about kind of the numbers, which is what everybody wants to know about. But why God would create anyone who's damned is still a tough one. It's a difficult question. And in that, we're partially given an answer in the sense that he wants them to be saved and to come to knowledge of the truth. It says this very explicitly. St. Paul says this. Nevertheless, he knows that they won't. It's not like he's surprised by their bad decisions. So he wills the good. They choose not to cooperate with that plan. And so I don't know why he creates them anyway. I think we can say in a certain sense his justice is shown in this. We can see that his love is shown in this and that he's willing to create people, even those who will reject him, because he loves them and he wants good things for them. But there is something still that I think is unsatisfactory about that answer. And I think we shouldn't shy away from the fact that there is something that is the mystery of iniquity, as Scripture says, that there's something mysterious about why sin has such a place in the world. And it's not ultimately something that Christ comes in and explains away or answers. It's rather that he transforms sin and iniquity and all of this by offering a kind of a plan of salvation.
Amanda, thank you so much for the question. We're going to take a quick break and we'll do another video question when we come back. How about
that?
Sounds good. All right, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one, Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because, if you look in the Catechism, you will see the fruits of Holy Communion. And these are remarkable things that we can receive at every Mass that we attend. We encounter the risen Lord, and He shares something of His divine life and love with us.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We got video questions today. It's the first time we've done that from the members of Society 315, our giving society. And do I have two videos left to go or one video?
Two.
I got two. All right. Let's roll the next video for Joe then. So we'll make sure we get everybody on with Joe. We don't want to exclude anybody who sent us a video. So go ahead, roll the next one.
Stay live. And then what? Catholic Answers. My name is Eric, and I'm calling from Coral Gables, Florida. My question is in regards to John 6, I think it's 57, when Jesus is speaking of how our ancestors ate manna and then died. Could you help me understand, you know, what is this? What is the manna then? Was it strictly for sustenance in order to live an earthly life? And then what is he referring to when he states that they died? Was he speaking just spiritually or bodily? Thank you.
Okay, first of all, his video was fine.
Yes, there was just video a glitch department had one job.
No, I'm not blaming the video department. I just don't want people to think, boy, Eric in Coral Gables doesn't know how to make a video. He made a perfectly good video. It just glitched on us a little bit. Sorry about that, Eric. Great question.
Yes, it was a great question. Although he did have one glitch. He did have the wrong verse. It's actually John 6:49.
Why did we even play that video then?
Eric, come on.
Good Lord, Joe. All right.
In John 6:49, Jesus is responding. So to give a little bit of context, he's performed the miraculous multiplication of loaves, and then the crowds find Jesus the next day, and they want more miracles because free food. I don't think I need to explain that anymore. But they're missing the point. They're focusing just on the free food. And Jesus is very clear about who he is. And they keep asking for manna. When he says he can perform miracles, they're like, well, Moses gave us manna. So it's another like, could we get more free food from you? And it's in this context that he says that he is the bread which comes down from heaven. And then he tells them that your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. This is the bread which comes down from heaven that a man may eat of it and not die. And so you say, okay, well, what's going on there? Because if you say bodily death, well, people who receive the Eucharist don't like live on earth forever. There's still bodily death for Catholics. If you say spiritual death, is he saying that everyone in the Exodus went to hell? I mean, it just seems right. Like, so it's a really good question because he's actually referring to both modes, but you have to be careful about kind of how he's referring to each one. First, when you're talking about the manna, what's the point of the manna? And when Israel's in the wilderness, they're starving. And in response to this, God sends a miraculous bread from heaven. And the point of this bread is twofold. First, it is to meet the bodily needs that they have. Second, by that, it's to reveal something about who he is. And so the point of all of Jesus's like bodily miracles, you know, the healings and the multiplication of loaves and all of this. First, there is a meeting of the real needs people have because God wants to meet your needs materially. But second, your deeper needs aren't material, they're spiritual. And so he wants you to see the same God who loves you and cares about you enough to make sure you have some food, loves you and cares about you enough to make sure you have eternal life. And so seeing the first thing should lead you to believe in the second thing. And so it's in this sense that we can talk about the Israelites in the desert. They eat of the manna and still die. That temporal food was not meant to last forever. The manna stops when they get to the promised land. It's meant to inspire faith. But 1 Corinthians 10 is really clear that many of those who received the physical manna don't live this life of faith. They don't trust God there. They're constantly second-guessing and saying they'd be better off back in Egypt and all of this. And so they, in many cases, don't receive the spiritual life from it because they refuse to kind of internalize the message of this miracle. So in that sense, your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and they died. All of them die physically. Some of them seem to have also died spiritually. In terms of this bread which comes down from heaven, that you may eat of it and not die, that does not mean you're preserved from bodily death because unlike the manna in the wilderness, the Eucharist is not primarily intended to make sure you don't starve in the desert. The Eucharist is to make sure that you don't starve spiritually, that it's about spiritually meeting your needs. And that's the whole point of what he's saying here, that here's this crowd of people who are focused on having their material needs met because they're physically hungry. And yes, Jesus can do that, but let's not get hung up on that because there's a deeper hunger that needs to be met as well, which is what he's providing in himself and in particularly in this Eucharistic way.
Eric, thanks very, very much for the question. I want to get everybody on, as I said, who submitted a video. And so we go to Reuben and Jade in Indiana.
Hello, my name is Reuben.
My name is Jude.
We're from Indiana, and we love calling you guys.
And our question is, can a priest consecrate something besides a host, like an apple?
Okay, the answer to that is no. So you can't just say, all right, I've got an apple, I've got, you know, a juice box over here, I'm going to turn this into the Eucharist. It doesn't work like that. And the reason it doesn't work like that is that Jesus says, do this with bread and wine. And so the do this includes the bread and wine. It doesn't just mean do whatever you want. And so, you know, when he tells the apostles, do this in remembrance of me, he's giving specific instructions. Now, obviously, there are going to be differences that the next time the apostles go to celebrate the Mass, well, for one, Jesus isn't sitting there next to them. So already it's going to be a different sort of thing. And it's going to look different every time it's performed throughout the ages. Different people, different contexts, different cultures. There is a sort of variation that'll happen. And, you know, most of the time the Mass is celebrated in the morning, say, whereas the Last Supper is clearly in the evening. So he's not saying you have to do it at a certain time of day, but there are certain things that if you don't have them, you're no longer doing this. You're doing something unrelated or something that's just not that. And so bread and wine have to be used. Now, most of the time, this issue isn't going to be relevant in terms of like an apple or those things. Where that does come up in those kind of extreme situations would be, for instance, when St. Maximilian Kolbe is in the concentration camp in Auschwitz, he can't celebrate Mass most of the time that he's there because he doesn't have bread and wine. It has to be smuggled in because one of the ways that they tortured priests was depriving them of the ability to celebrate Mass. So in those cases, you can see very clearly you actually need bread and wine. And it's not enough even to just have one or the other because that's not what Jesus, those are not the instructions we've been left. And you know, the Eucharist isn't just like a magic trick. It's a participation in this thing Christ has done and then told the priest to do. The other way this comes up is less extreme than like an apple. You had some weird liturgical dabbling in like the 70s. I don't know if you've heard about this or not.
But don't Reuben and Jude are young and impressionable. Don't scandalize, talk about the 70s with them. just go over that.
There was a bad time before you were born. And so you had people who would try to do weird things that weren't unleavened bread and wine. Now, I say unleavened bread because we're in the West. If you're in the East, you use leavened bread. Those are the valid forms of matter. If you try to use something besides that, it's not a valid Mass. And so the last place this comes up is some of the modern things that we call wine. There are big question marks as to what they are. So something like Franzia, where is this natural wine or is this something else? Because if it's something else, it can't be used in Mass. And so
I'm guessing that neither Reuben, Jude, nor myself know what that thing is that you
said. Oh, Franzia is $3 wine or wine something. It's like boxed wine. And some of the boxed wine is not properly sourced. And so you like the Vatican is actually very clear. There are instructions in a circular letter about this. You have to use natural wine. You can't use like wine mixed with a bunch of other stuff.
Oh, I see. So it's
like
kind
a wine cooler is not valid matter for Mass.
Right. Bartles and James.
Yeah, we have different, I think, budgets, I guess. I don't know what Bartles and James is.
Well, thank you for your support. All right, Reuben and Jude, I'm sorry I said Jade. I don't know why I did that. That was a very good question. It was nice to see you sitting on the lawn with Mary. Did you see Mary behind them?
Yeah.
That was very nice, both of you, and thank you for the video. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest. Bartles and James were the original wine cooler.
Oh.
And they used to have commercials where Bartles and James were sitting on the front porch, and at the end of the commercial they would say, and thank you for your support. It was you look it up on the internet.
It doesn't sound like a good commercial, but maybe it is.
They were very good commercials.
Yeah? Okay.
They sold about $1 trillion worth of wine coolers, and no one had ever even heard of a wine cooler until then. All right, I want to read this question from Anne in Pittsburgh, who starts it out really well. I like when a person starts out really well at the beginning of the question. And like everybody on this program today, one of the donors to Society 315, as I said, living in Pittsburgh, I would love to ask Cy and Joe a question. Thank you so much, Anne, for throwing me in there. I'm going to answer this question now.
Good.
Don't say good like you think you're going to do better than me.
Oh, no, I'm giving this one over to you. I'll sit back and see how it goes.
I am part of a Christian Facebook group open to all Christian denominations, and recently someone made a comment about St. Paul being a heretic. I was curious if this is a belief of a particular denomination and what the roots of this claim comes from. I have never heard a Christian claim this and wanted to know the argument better.
How would you answer that, Sam?
I would start by from the very earliest days of St. Paul's preaching and teaching, he was an extremely controversial creature. Many Christians did call him a heretic. They were called Judaizers because he said you didn't have to keep the Jewish ceremonial laws. You didn't have to keep kosher and all of that. And even St. Peter said Paul's teaching is very complicated. He certainly did not reject Paul. And then even the church fathers struggled with St. Paul, I think Tertullian in particular. Today, there continue to be Christian Judaizers. It's something that you will run into. It's probably not common, but it is something you'll run into. I don't know, and Joe will have to help me with this, if that is an aspect of Messianic Judaism, which is a form of Christianity. Paul is called a heretic by people who continue to believe that his dismissing people from the celebration of feasts and the feast seasons of the Jewish calendar was wrong. They think that he did the wrong thing. How is that?
You think that's good? The Ebionites were another early group. So you have two of the earliest heresies. I mean, the first wave, you've got like Gnosticism, you've got the Judaizer heresy you just mentioned. But then after this, you get in the 100s, two kind of extreme heresies that are trying to understand how to synthesize the understanding of the Old and New Testament. And so in one direction, you've got Marcion, who says the God of the Old Testament is evil, the God of the New Testament is good. Mm-hmm. And so that's one bad answer. That's clearly wrong. And in response to that, you have the Ebionites who say, no, the Old Testament is good and St. Paul is bad because St. Paul breaks from the Old Testament. And that's a bad answer, too. And so the actual answer is that St. Paul is an observant Jew who, entering the New Covenant, realizes that parts of the Old Covenant were meant as a preparation for the New Covenant. They weren't meant to just be permanent institutions. So in terms of who still believes this today, you won't find, like, I don't want to say mainstream Messianic Judaism, because I'm not sure it's a particularly mainstream movement. But if you imagine Messianic movement within itself, the core of it, I think most Messianic Jews would not subscribe to this. But you will find some more Ebionite or Judaizer Messianic Jews who do say, yeah, maybe we need to have a radical look and reject Paul so we can be more faithful to being Jewish. And this is all a bad route.
Then there's the opposite thing that some people do, and I don't know which denominations this is, where they say the teachings of Jesus were for the Jews and only Paul is a teacher for the Christians. That's very odd theology.
Yeah, there's a form of dispensationalism that does say with every book, well, who's the audience? And if the audience is to the Jews, we can basically, and they don't say we can ignore it, but they do say it's not written to us. And so some of it you can just kind of ignore. I had this very profound encounter where I was talking to a street preacher. And when he found out I was Catholic, he started lambasting us for our unwritten traditions. And he's like, where in the Bible does it say baptism saves you? And I said, okay, you got a KJV. Open up to 1 Peter 3:21 and just read what it says. And he just reads baptism, which corresponds to this, now saves you. And he stops and goes, well, that was written to the Jews. I was just like, what? Like, baptism isn't salvific in the Old Covenant.
Wait, no, but that wasn't his question. His question was, where in the Bible?
I know. It was like the goalpost got moved within seconds when he realized that he had just not realized that verse was in there.
Yeah.
But it was strange watching this bizarre defense mechanism where you could just sift out the kinds of New Testament teachings you don't want to hear. Yeah. So when James talks about the necessity of works for salvation, you can say, oh, well, that's just for the Jews, or that's the Old Covenant, or any of these kind of. And that is, once you start playing those kind of games of deciding which parts of the New Testament apply to you and which don't, you are in something other than New Testament Christianity.
And you better be careful. I mean, if your theology involves there are words of Jesus that are not addressed to me personally, you are in the wrong church, because the words of Jesus are universally normative for all people in all times in all places.
Right. Even if they're not addressed to you, they're meant for you as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. And I really, thanks for including me in that. Boy, that went fast, Joe. And you and Michelle had a great idea. I say we do this again. As a matter of fact, I kind of see a future in this, doing video questions. We'll have to figure out some mechanism where that people can get them to us. But I think there's a future in this.
Yeah, Joe? It's fun actually getting to see the people coming in.
Your latest book, Joe. What's just say the latest
the
one.
The Eucharist is really Jesus.
It's out?
No, but it will be.
Oh, okay. The Eucharist is really Jesus.
The early church was the Catholic Church. It's the last to be released.
Oh, okay. So. I was all like, I didn't get a copy. I was all mad for a second.
July for that one.
Really? Congratulations, yeah, Joe. Wonderful. All right, that does it for us. Happy Memorial Day. And thank God and pray again for all those who gave their life in the service of this country or your country. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.